your passion lies in Elite British Road Racing and you want an inside line on the teams, riders, organisers and sponsors that make this sport such a compelling spectacle, you're in the right place. I'm Timothy John, and joining me for every episode is my co-host, the Managing Director of Brother UK, Bill Jones.
Thanks, Tim. It's great to be here. We're going to use this platform to talk about all the key issues surrounding the sport. With special guests, deep dives into hot topics and plenty of chat, we'll keep you informed about all things UK racing. Stay tuned.
Coming up in this extended conversation with the managers of Brother UK's sponsored cycling teams. We hear how the double whammy of Brexit and COVID is already affecting Britain's biggest teams.
Paperwork and form filling and the PCR tests, not only is it a huge, huge headache, we've got coronavirus and Brexit at the same time, so it's like double trouble really.
We learn how the competitive DNA of racers to managers leaves them well placed to adapt to cycle sport's shifting dynamic.
Good road bike riders, we need to be adaptable, we need to change, we need to be ready to find new things, find new ways. I think that's why, as our cyclists and road riders, then that's what you give.
We discover why a positive outlook allows team managers to focus on new goals when racing is suspended by lockdown.
Even though there's no racing on right now, there's still small wins to take along the way. And that might be securing a sponsorship deal with a sponsor you've always wanted to be part of your team. Or that might be signing a rider that you've always wanted to sign. And actually, when you can do that and pull something like that off, it motivates you massively.
And we hear how sophisticated studies of human motivation used by business leaders are equally applicable to cycle team management.
In my day-to-day world, we have a clear distinction between people that are intrinsically motivated and people that are extrinsically motivated. So some people can, without any race program, still get up every morning, get out, get on the bike, whatever the weather. Their motivation comes from inside. But for others, of course, their motivation comes from working towards something like a race program or a particular race that they're targeting.
Hello and welcome to the Brother UK Cycling Podcast, where the topic under discussion today is management. Now, managing a cycling team takes knowledge, experience, skill and perseverance. It demands tactical nous and commercial acumen, a strategic view and the personal touch, the ability to identify talent and to retain it. The skills required to lead a cycling team and a major business are very closely aligned. In this eighth episode of the Brother UK Cycling Podcast, we have a panel able to speak with authority on every aspect of a cycling team manager's job. And in the form of my co-host, Phil Jones, the Managing Director of Brother UK, we have the leader of a major business. We'll cast an unblinking eye upon the demands and rewards of management, both in normal conditions, whatever that might mean, and in the new normal of COVID-19. Simon Howes manages Team Brother UK On Form, a development team for men and women, junior and senior, and he manages the CAMS Tifosi UCI women's team, a squad formerly known as Brother UK Tifosi, powered by On Form. Ian Watson is the manager of Team Brother UK LDN, an elite British women's team born from CC London, a club he co-founded to share the education that guided his own development through the sport in the Northwest scene of the 1980s. Matt Hallam manages Crimson Performance Orientation Marketing, a Brother UK sponsored team for men and women. Based in Manchester and founded to provide opportunities to riders in the Northwest, Matt's squad has rapidly gained a propulsive momentum that even COVID can't slow. Simon, Ian, Matt, Phil, thank you very much indeed for joining me. Well, it's already been a tumultuous sort of start to the year, really. We've got events being cancelled left, right and centre. We've had a number of rider transfers over the winter. The European season seems to have got off to a flying start. So let's have a brief sort of roundup of the major developments in road racing since January, focusing really on Brother UK's interest in the scene. On the rider front, of course, we'll hear from our team managers about their new signings. But among Brother Cycling's graduates to the UCI World Tour were Simon's protégé, Anna Henderson, has moved from Team DSM, what previously was Sunweb, to Jumbo-Visma's new women's squad. Sophie Wright has signed with the UCI Women's World Tour squad LA BTC Ljubljana in a deal agreed before the demise of Equipe Paul-Car, and Harry Tanfield will begin his third World Tour campaign in 3 years with a third different team, having signed for Quebec-Arasos. Simon, Anna's move to Jumbo-Visma has kind of gone under the radar, presumably because she's still a very young rider. But given that the team's already signed Marianne Vos, and presumably the squad's going to get a similar level of investment and standard to its men's team, that's a pretty big move, isn't it, for Anna?
Yeah, it's a great move for her. Like you said already, Marianne's there, which Oshi, for anybody of any age, can only but learn and take knowledge and experience from her. For Anna, it's a good move because there's a wide range of riders, but many of them are similar to Anna, where they're newer to the sport, less experience. So for her, it'll be a good opportunity to for her race program to increase. So yeah, really good opportunity for her.
Turning our attention now to the domestic scene, and unfortunately the story here sadly is one of races cancelled or postponed. The National Road Series, obviously it's kind of the focus of Brother UK Cycling's interest. We provide the neutral service vehicles and we have three sponsored teams competing in that series. Well, that calendar unfortunately has already been decimated. On the men's side, the Klondike Grand Prix, the Tour of the Reservoir, the Stockton Grand Prix have already been cancelled, while the Lincoln Grand Prix has only been postponed, so fingers crossed for that one. The men's series doesn't begin now until July with the Beaumont Trophy. On the women's side, it's a similar picture, but with a significant silver lining in the news that the Women's Cycle Classic will take place as scheduled on June the 27th, and that makes it sort of the de facto opening round of the Women's National Road Series. If we step away from the National Road Series for a moment, then Britain's handful of UCI races have suffered too. The Men's Cycle Classic has been cancelled, the Ride London races for men and women are cancelled, and the women's tour has been postponed from June to October. The Tour of Britain, which is still scheduled for September, is so far unaffected. So that gives us a decent jumping off point, I reckon. One of the topics I wanted to tackle today was the challenge that you guys face in putting together a race programme and choosing a calendar in normal circumstances, never mind with the challenges of COVID-19 and lockdown. All of these cancellations, of course, are entirely understandable, but it cannot make your job any easier. Ian, let's start with you. What kind of headache do this raft of cancellations provide you, and how do you work around that?
Yeah, it is difficult. It's disappointing for the riders because, of course, they're just desperate to get back racing again. I think it's slightly different this year because we had the big disappointment of last year. I'm finding it a bit easier to manage our expectations around potential cancellations, in a sense of there's a kind of inevitability about it. We've missed like pretty much a year of racing. We want an ease into the racing season. Klondike was a big disappointment, but it's just managing the expectations of the riders. And I think we just want to know when it's going to start and when there's going to be a season. So if it's going to be June, it's going to be June, and that's fine. And we'll have that. My job is to just keep the riders informed of all times. That's where it falls down, is if the riders don't know what's going on, or they're second guessing, or they're just waiting for it. But as long as we keep them informed and notified of everything that's going on, then it's not quite as bad as what was last year.
Last year you kind of left no stone unturned in looking for European races that your team might compete in. Ultimately, you sort of came right up against the Tour de l'Ardèche late in the season as your team's season opener, and decided that ideally, you know, that was suboptimal to say the least. But have you got an eye on the European calendar already? Is that an option to fill gaps, or does Brexit present a whole range of problems there?
It's exactly that, really. My plan for the girls now is to try and get to Belgium and some of the lesser UCI races. So we have been accepted to a race in France in which would have been the same weekend as Klondike. However, we've got a logistical problem with that can we get there? And if we get there, can we get home again? without quarantine. So we're in the race, and we just got to hope that there's travel restrictions are lifted by then. And then the other thing that I want the girls to do more on the basis that if there's not racing in the UK is that we go and do more Kermesses and things like that in Belgium so that we can get that better race experience before the national series starts. But again, yeah, we've got the travel restrictions from COVID and then the Brexit thing, so we don't know at the moment. So I'm doing the same as what I did last year. I'm leaving no stone unturned, and I'm keeping an eye on the news.
So a question I had, actually, I just wanted to come back to Ian on there, was actually, is everybody happy to travel, even if the opportunity comes up? Because I know in my own organisation that we've got a broad church of different thinking, where some people are not keen to come back to the office, others are really keen to come back to the office. And I wondered if the same applied in cycling teams, that actually, even though you're saying we'd like to go and maybe race a Kermesse or go to Belgium, that not everybody perhaps wants to go, either for their own health reasons or for the fact that actually in their day job, and many of the riders we have in the UK are working, you know, working full time as well as riding and racing. And their employers indeed might say, well, we don't actually want you to travel abroad, or we can't afford to have you isolating and all that kind of stuff. So I just wondered how the practicalities of managing COVID also, you know, turn up actually in squad members.
Yeah, well, definitely the it's been a group decision to do that. It's not just my decision saying, all right, we'll go abroad and do that. One of the biggest things I've done over this lockdown, of compared to the last one or over this season, is we have every other week we're having a meeting now, and I send out weekly updates via email to the riders, because it's communication all the time. So yeah, we had a sit down, well, online sit down, a few sit downs to talk about how we can start the season and what we can do, and that is partly their suggestion as well to do that. That's what they want to do, because the riders, that's where they're looking to progress as well. Regarding the restrictions and quarantines, I'm not sure how it works with their employers. Most of the riders have got flexibility with the work, and they've arranged that to have a good season. Well, they did last year, never mind this year. But I don't know how it works with them in quarantine. But to be honest with you, we wouldn't go away if we had to quarantine, because like you rightly said, all my riders are working. A couple of students, but majority are all working, so that couldn't happen.
Matt, what's your feeling? And then perhaps we can hear from Simon straight after.
Yeah, well, there's no hesitation on the riders' part. They all want to race. They're absolutely craving pinning a number on and getting back to it. So everyone's circumstances are slightly different. We've got guys that have worked full-time. We've got guys that are full-time bike riders. So everyone's circumstances are slightly different. So logistics of making that happen when it comes to taking a squad abroad, for example. And then we have to quarantine on return. When you're taking riders that are actually employed, that becomes difficult. And that's up to them to decide whether they want to use their holidays for that. It all boils down to the fact that everyone wants to race. There is no rider that doesn't want to go and race. It's harder when you cross the channel into Europe. It gets tricky. When you travel into Europe, there's so much to consider now. Whereas in previous years, it was a lot easier. So it makes our jobs as team managers significantly harder, the work we have to put in and the amount of planning that takes place to even consider doing a UCI race in Europe is significant now. So I think that, yeah, like I mentioned, everyone's circumstances are slightly different. On a rider perspective, it just boils down to whether they can make it work with their situation that they find themselves in employment or elsewhere.
Yeah, see, for myself, and I completely echo Ian's and Matt's viewpoints about each rider's individual, and it's up to them to make that decision. In truth, they shouldn't be forced into anything they don't want to do. But as you've mentioned, Tim, I have two hands in two camps, really, with a UK-based team and a UCI-based team. And interestingly, we are off to Europe in 2 to 3 weeks' time for a UCI race, a healthy aging tour. And as has already been alluded to, the paperwork and the form filling and the PCR tests, not only is it a huge, huge headache, and it's, you know, we've got coronavirus and Brexit at the same time. So it's like double trouble, really. And of course, it all comes back to a cost. There's quite a great cost involved in terms of your tests. You need special paperwork now to take, even to take a bike across the border. It's called a carnet. So yeah, it's challenging times. And, you know, I was a 19, 20-year-old racing in Europe as a young lad, and you jumped on a ferry. There was no train at the time, but you jumped on the ferry and off you went with your bike and your bag and travelled and spent a year racing whichever country you travelled to or around Europe. So, yeah, it's difficult times for the youngsters. You know, Dave Rayner Funds has been mentioned in numerous conversations. One benefit there is, and I guess it's something I'm slightly closer to, is this. We've mentioned quarantine and the restrictions. British Cycling and Cyclist Alliance, which is a sort of a union for female cyclists, women racers, are working closely together to look at getting elite status, which you possibly heard about, read about on social media and seen. So that can help and will help. But again, it's not freely available, and there's a lot of guidelines and restrictions to be able to receive that. So
a lot of time, or over the last sort of 6 weeks, speaking with Harry Tanfield, working on a feature article, and basically turning himself inside out, trying to find a way around this 90-day scenario, which he did eventually, courtesy of a visit to Her Majesty's Passport Office in Manchester. And then a couple of days later, there was Anna tweeted saying, "Help, how on earth do I get around this 90-day restriction?" You know, under the new Brexit rules, I think United Kingdom citizen can only work for 90 days in Europe without a special permit. And I referred her to Harry, so I hope she got that sorted. But it's good to hear now that BC are on the case. Just to return to this, you know, where we started with a roundup talking about the decimation of the UK calendar. And Matt, I just wanted to ask you about that because, you know, Simon, as we say, has got two teams, one of which is mainly focused on Europe anyway. Ian, a big part of the education for his riders, is taking them across to Europe. But with Crimson, my understanding was, you know, you had some pretty serious goals, particularly with the men's team, on the National Road Series this year. That it was a forum in which you could really have made an impact. Just how disappointing is it to see all of these races cancelled so quickly when it seemed that BC with Eric, you know, had finally sort of got a way forward and put together a pretty impressive calendar?
Of course, it was disappointing to see races being cancelled so early. We've got to remember that we have 8 opportunities here with the National Road Series and 3 are now gone. So we're left with 5 races. Yeah, it's disappointing on a personal level as well, not being able to showcase the team and the riders in all 8 of those races. Some great opportunities there for my riders that were tailoring their training accordingly to the specific demands of those certain races. So when they're gone, it's back to the drawing board again. So yeah, you can, I mentioned this already in a previous chat we had, Tim, but you can either look at it and be really negative around the whole situation, or you can do the opposite and be positive. And that's the way I take it. So there are still opportunities there. We have to take the ones that come. Let's think of the positives here. We've still got the Tour Series that's been rescheduled. What a massive opportunity that is this year. We've still got all the rounds of the Criterium Series. As far as I'm aware, they're all still going ahead. You have to feed that positivity into the riders, because if you start showing this negative attitude towards that, the doom and gloom of COVID and Brexit, and everything doesn't seem to be going very well with domestic racing, the riders feed off that. And then the next thing you know, they stop training, they're not motivated. What's the point? So that's just not the way I do things with running my team. So it's frustrating, of course. These opportunities are really limited anyway. We have 8 races, which, let's face it, guys, it's not many. We have 1 stage race, which is a 2-day stage race. UCI races are gone. So, the ones we had in the pipeline anyway, but yeah, like I said, we've got to look forward to what's on offer this year in the UK. We've got to take all those opportunities that come our way. And yeah, the big one for us now is preparing for targeting some serious results in the Circuit Series and Tour Series now.
Pick up about, you know, there are just 8 opportunities. There isn't much racing. You know, we, in our investigative episode and in the last episode where Larry, Phil and I talked about, you know, Eric's ambition for a tiered structure, I just wanted to get your sense on that, Matt, really, because, and in fact, all 3 of the managers here, the volume of racing, the quantity of racing, the number of opportunities that exist, you know, how can that challenge be addressed and overcome? Is it, as Eric seems to be suggesting with a greater segmentation, a more tiered approach, or is that approaching it from the wrong direction?
I think it boils down to the organisers, let's face it. We need more organisers wanting to put these National A road races on. Without that type of person steering the ship, it's never going to go anywhere. And that takes a lot, really. You've got to remember these race organisers are doing it for the love of the sport, and a lot comes with putting a race on. There's a lot of admin, a lot of potential headaches that come along the way. So yeah, British Cycling need to make it appealing to these race organisers to be, you know, proactive with putting these big races on, because we need more of them. We need more people wanting to step up and organise races that can cater for the country's best riders.
Is that the case too, Ian, on the women's side? Are there enough races to go around? We hear a lot that, you know, although the National Road Series, when, you know, when COVID permissions permit, is comprehensive. That was the view certainly from Bex Durrell when we spoke in the investigative edition. But we also hear that there just aren't enough National B races. There aren't enough below that top tier to keep things going. How does it look from the women's side of the sport?
100%, yeah. I mean, we'd like it, as many National A races as what there is for men. You know, we have 5 compared to 8 for the men, and we'd like as many for those. But you're definitely right, because there's no National B. And in fact, I think in 2019, there was an absolute handful of first cat road races that were going around, because trying to prop up the bottom of the sport, there was lots of 2, 3, 4 road races and things like that, but there was hardly any first cat road races. And I've got a few first cat riders on the team, and it's hard. So yeah, I mean, it'd be nice to have you know, more of like a National B series for women, certainly as it's getting bigger and more in depth.
Bill, you were going to come in a moment again.
Yeah, I thought it was such an interesting point that, you know, when you did your opening today, Tim, we talked about, you know, the job of a team manager, and of course there's the operational side, but there's also this human factor, isn't there, about how we motivate people, which I think, you know, we have in common. So I have that in common with you know, with the people on the call today, in that we've got to somehow motivate people. But I thought Matt's point was very interesting, that you know, certainly in my day-to-day world, we have a clear distinction between people that are intrinsically motivated and people are extrinsically motivated. So some people can, without any race program, still get up every morning, deliver, get out, get on the bike, whatever the weather, and they actually, their motivation comes from inside. But for others, of course, this is just human factors. Their motivation comes from working towards something like a race program or a particular race that they're targeting. And of course, for the people who are more intrinsically motivated, the disappointment of races disappearing or moving, they'll probably be a little bit more resilient to that. But for the people who are much more driven by, I'm working towards that goal on that date and that's what's driving me, I think that I realise in my own business that actually we needed to sort of continually create new goals to deal with some of those disappointments, to say, well, look, we were thinking about this. Now that's got to happen. So we would set specifically a new milestone of some kind, where those people, particularly like our salespeople, for example, who are very extrinsically motivated, they could still continue to have something that they feel that they're working towards. The second point I wanted to make was also, you know, back to one of those earlier points, which was about positive pragmatism, that sometimes you can be overly optimistic, which actually takes your team to have bigger disappointment, or then you can be, you know, overly pessimistic, which then all the heads go down. So it's about finding that positive pragmatism in amongst all of that, to say, well, look, there is bad news and it's this. Let's all just deal with that. But in amongst that, we've got to do this. And so sort of constantly keeping people reset and on some sort of journey with you is probably, you know, a bit of my life that I think corresponds quite well to what Ian, Matt and Simon are having to do with the teams that effectively they're trying to hold together of riders.
It's a very interesting point. And it's actually one I think all of you guys can comment on, is it seems to me an essential characteristic of a manager, whether it be in business or in sport, to be optimistic. I don't think I've ever encountered a pessimistic leader. You've got to have that natural optimism. And Simon, over our conversations over the years, that's come across loud and clear. I think you're more than a glass half full person. You're a glass overflowing person. But that can't always be easy to maintain. How do you keep your spirits up when things aren't going quite as you hoped they would.
Well, I guess, you know, short term and long term, it will improve. There will become a time when these conversations will be long in history and they'll be revisited. But, you know, the future is the future and we have to look forward to the future. I think also as sportsmen, women, motivation and self-motivation is something that makes them different to someone who doesn't take sport seriously. For example, I'm amazed at the motivation that riders still have, how they can get up every morning, 9 o'clock, they're at their door, rain, cold, wind, all these reasons. And you know, the managers on this screen here have all been cyclists and cyclists ourselves still. So I think it comes from participating in sport and being around sports people. Yeah, as I say, their motivation is just immense. And as we say, communication, I think, is the key message that someone's already mentioned. You just have to keep communication lines open, share the information, share what you know, don't hold stuff back, and just be honest with each other because everyone understands and we're all in this together. And actually, that's the bottom line, really.
Matt, you're another guy that's positive by nature, and the conversations we've had, you describe it almost as a choice. And again, it's an attitude that doesn't only affect your team, it affects your business too. Day to day, you're a bike fitter, very well-respected bike fitter, and you faced all kinds of problems initially last year with the first lockdown when suddenly a business that seemed to rely entirely on face-to-face contact was taken away from you. It didn't take you long to adapt and to get a new system in place. But I think your underlying ability to do that, to make that adaptation, was you'd made that conscious choice almost to face that situation positively.
Some of this will echo what Simon's just mentioned there. Still classify myself as an athlete. I train a lot. I still race at a high level. And that resilience that comes with leading a lifestyle like that has done me a world of good in my career as well. Because there's problems that you can face through what you do with your career. You reflect on things you've done as a rider and how you've overcame those obstacles too. And there's quite a good synergy between both. You kind of roll with the punches as they come. And we do that in bike racing as well. You know, more often than not, races don't go as well as you hope. But you bounce back and you come back stronger. I think from my bike fit side of things that I've had to completely pivot how my business operates as I'm actually not able to offer the services that I make my livelihood doing. I've had to do things virtually now, and it took quite a lot of preparation to be able to do that and still offer a really good service in the first lockdown. I didn't think I'd be going back to doing that, if I'm honest with you, but here we are again. And almost 2 months down the line of this third lockdown. And yeah, I'm very fortunate to be able to still be doing that and having quite good success with the amount of people that come through the virtual channels of that. And I feed on that positivity as well. Small wins at the moment. I think, you know, you just got to give yourselves a pat on the back when things are going quite well. And from a manager's perspective, that's really important too. Even though there's no racing on right now at the moment for a lot of us, there's still small wins to take along the way. And that might be securing a sponsorship deal with a sponsor you've always wanted to be part of your team. Or that might be signing a rider that you've always wanted to sign. And actually, when you can do that and pull something like that off, it motivates you massively and it makes you a lot more positive.
Can I ask a quick question then? One of the things that when you are leading teams particularly, and you guys are leading teams, is actually you're often having to give a lot to other people all the time. There's an awful lot of emotion that you're putting out all the time to sort of make sure everyone else is okay. Who's looking after you? Who is it that you rely on to keep going in order that you can support everyone else? Simon, do you want to answer that first? Then we come to Ian and then maybe Matt?
We have our family, our friends and our, those within the team as well. We all support each other. Everyone has good days, everyone has bad days. So again, you know, we have our Zoom calls, our weekly catch-up. You might not know, but we actually have a team psychologist within our support room. I guess we take it almost to the next level by having a psychologist within our support group. But yeah, it's important and really, really important during current challenging times.
What about you, Ian?
I think if I talk for myself personally, I think my support comes from, I think the motivation to do this, because you say it can be difficult at times. It's not a paid job to be the manager itself, and yet it has its challenges. But I think when you've got a good team around you, you pick the right team, you've got a good team around you, and you've got the expectation as those riders, that lifts you, you know, and that lifts you and gives you the motivation and that positivity to carry on forward. And just seeing the changing people and the helping people, that's the support I get. That's all I need to keep me going and make me realise that, yeah, this is a good thing to do. We also have, you know, we do have a tea psychologist, and I do have a few good people in the background staff as well who support me very, very well and help me out as well. But I'd say a lot of it comes from the riders. You know, you get lifted.
Great. Matt, what about you?
What Simon and Ian have mentioned there resonates a lot. Again, echoing what Ian mentioned with regards to the group of riders that you have, and you almost feel committed to them. And I'm still fortunate. I've got a core group of riders that I had when I started the team back in 2018. And they're a good group of friends now. And they've been along the journey with me too, and it's great to have them involved. And yeah, just things like that lift you, and friends and family. And it's a tough job managing a race team. There's no doubt about that. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort, and you have to be intrinsically motivated to do it. I guess you kind of, you're almost like a carrot on the stick with why you're doing it, because you can see things growing year on year. And yeah.
But one of the sort of striking comparisons I think Simon made earlier was that, but actually you've all raced yourself. So you've all been competitive bike racers yourself. So when you look back, perhaps at the DNA of each of you all, you've probably got a discipline and a mindset DNA somewhere in you all, which is probably quite common. And that perhaps gives you that ability to perhaps have that resiliency a little bit more, because you can deal with disappointment of you know, getting a result in a race or not being what, you know, the result that you wanted, bouncing back. So, you know, resiliency, I think, has been a really big word, I think, over the last year or so, how individual resiliency has been really tested. And perhaps people that are racing and managing race teams seem to have perhaps a stronger resiliency perhaps than those that don't compete in competitive sport.
Yeah, I think so, because I think you mentioned the word resilience, which is which we have to, you know, because we're all road riders as well. So, you know, you have to have that resilience to race and with all things. But the other thing that you definitely have to do as a bike racer is you have to be adaptable. You have to be adaptable to change, because anything can happen in a race, and anything does happen in a race. You know, the strongest person doesn't win a road race. You know, the strongest person might win a time trial, but it's not necessarily the strongest person win a road race. So you have to be adaptable, and adaptable to change and changing circumstances and that sort of thing. So that kind of leads into what this last year that we've just had. You know, if we're bike riders and good road bike riders, we need to be adaptable. We need to change. We need to be ready to find new things, find new ways. And that's what we do. So yeah, I think, I'm not going to speak for all of us, but I think that's why, as past cyclists and road riders, then that's what you give.
Is it getting easier that this latest lockdown, Matt? You use the phrase, you know, here we are again, and Ian talks about adaptability. The adaptations that all of you will have made last year, Phil from a business perspective, and the managers from a sporting perspective. How many of those are still relevant? Is it easier this time around? Have you got strategies in place that you developed last year? Matt, let's start with you on that one.
Yeah, definitely. Found a bit of a formula with what worked well last year. Even though we had no racing on offer, we still were able to provide return of investment to our sponsors and keep the team really visible, which was our biggest goal. So we're going to use some of that structure heading into this year, mix that in with some racing, fingers crossed. We're back to the race grid again and competing at a high level. I think we're going to have quite a nice blend of what worked well for last year and what we can do differently this year. Got a content strategy in place already for this year, and we've got some really good ideas that are going to help to keep the team really visible on social and digital platforms. So I think we're certainly on the right path with the strategy we have in place.
So here's a question. Do you reckon there's going to be a load of crashes, guys, once racing resumes, because no one's used to riding a bunch anymore? They've been on Zwift too long and they've forgotten how to ride in a bunch. What do you reckon?
There's going to be a lot of eager cyclists out there, that's for sure. But it shouldn't take long. And, you know, the level that many of our riders are, our experienced riders. So they don't want to crash as much as the person next to them, do they? So that's the main thing.
Do you think a few matches are going to get burned early season? Because, of course, we've seen some of the World Tour stuff, haven't we? How much a rider has actually been riding through the winter on Zwift and all that kind of good stuff. And we've seen very different performances from people in early season. So I think the first couple of UK road races, when they get going, are going to be quite interesting, really. I guess people are going to want to show their form. But equally, there could be a few dark horses who might have been quietly burning away, you know, the Zwift miles in the garage.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's brilliant. I mean, I watched World Tour racing, and towards the end of last year with the late race programme and certainly the start of this year, the racing's been absolutely brilliant, and I've been watching bike racing for a very, very long time. So, it's exciting, and you do hope there's new riders that come through that you've not seen or heard of before, because that's what we all strive to achieve, isn't it? To find riders that are the next star, the next future. So, let's hope so.
Maybe that's the ultimate adaptation the sport made last year. I remember when, you know, it was first announced that the season would run from August to November at World Tour level. It seemed insane. And yet it was wonderful that we had brilliant racing week after week. We barely had time to catch your breath before the next race. And with things like Liège-Bastogne-Liège, for example, following the tour, we got a very different race, didn't we? We got all the Grand Tour contenders there. And of course, that incredible finish where Roglic buried the disappointment of the Tour de France emphatically by sweeping underneath Alaphilippe's outstretched arms on the finish line. I mean, this idea that, you know, the calendar, there is some flexibility built in almost by definition. Does that give you heart? An example within our world, of course, is that the Tour Series has been rescheduled now from May to August, that the Women's Tour, we think, is going to happen in October rather than June. It doesn't seem so fanciful this year, does it? We've had a template. We saw last year that events could be put back and still be run successfully. What sort of heart do you take from that? How about you, Simon? Your UCI team, Kams de Fossey, we'll hope to ride in the Women's Tour, of course.
Yeah, you take massive heart from that. That's what keeps us motivated and keeps us, say, training at 9 o'clock every morning out the door. So, it's massively important. And seeing new dates for events is really, really key. You mentioned the Tour Series. You know, they announced with the Tour Series the potential to go and race in America on the USA Crit Series for the winners. So, you know, the messages that appeared in group chats as soon as that was published was, you know, it just was endless and endless. So there's always key drivers, as we've sort of mentioned already. There'll always be a driver of some description that will make you train hard and stay motivated.
There's another sort of important perhaps concept, Tim, I just want to throw in there, because it's related to resiliency and probably related a bit to this chat. So there was a very, very good book called The Black Swan, which was written by a chap called Nassim Nicholas Taleb, professor. And what he was doing was talking about how these black swan events, which is very, very huge events, which almost come out of the blue, which we don't think exist, like COVID, for example. He made a distinction between resiliency, which is sort of maybe if you stretch an elastic band and let it go, the elastic band goes back to its previous form, right? It's an elastic band again. And then what he calls anti-fragility. And anti-fragility is actually that the elastic band would actually completely change its form in relation to being stretched, if you see what I mean. So it's not about just going back to how things were. What it actually anti-fragility about is actually how the system improves through the shock. So I wonder whether we all think that actually cycling will improve as a result of this shock. So we're seeing, I think, perhaps on the Tour Series, Simon, that they may consider integrating some Zwift racing alongside real life crit racing at the same time, for example. So it's almost kind of like you do the best of both. And it's not just one form of crit racing, but it's a couple of things bolted together, which might become the future of that series, for example. So do you think that's like a good thing that might come out of this, that actually we might get a different type of cycle sport? Or do you think it's better that we just go back to how things were and hopefully we're all just going to be going back to the same old race programme with the same old organisers and all that kind of stuff? I'm just interested.
Development's important, is it, amongst team sponsors, riders and events? And actually on a personal personal note, you mentioned the Tour Series being an e-racing event. I've forwarded that information onto the On-Form girls, and since then our group chat hasn't stopped buzzing. We've even spotted now that some riders are spending more time e-racing than they did before that announcement was made. So, you know, again, we've mentioned about small gains to create motivation. That's been exactly that. It's not even a small gain in truth. It's created a huge amount of excitement within the team, a chance to race Tour Series, which many of them haven't done before. So it's massive.
Because I've definitely seen a lot more of your riders across the various teams on Zwift. You know, your lot, Matt, and Ian, some of yours too. When you're seeing actually, you know, when you're looking at what the Stravas are doing, and occasionally you're on Zwift and you go, you can see somebody that you're following from one of the teams going, oh, they're racing again. So you clearly, I probably have seen much more e-racing from all members in your team over the past year than perhaps any period before.
It was a big win for you, Matt, last year, I seem to remember. You had wins with Alistair Thomas, with Leon Mazzone. I mean, how does that, you know, you spoke earlier about generating return on investment. How big a deal is e-racing in that context?
Yeah, it's a real asset for us as a team now and as it was last year. And, you know, I think before we go into this, I think we've got to tip our hats to Sweet Spot, and what they're doing at the moment is amazing, creating a lot of positivity around racing and I think British Cycling could learn a lot from that. So heading back to your point, Tim, we did a lot of these British Cycling Zwift, well, it was kind of like a mini series that they had. They had races every week and we participated in them. And yeah, we had some great results. We won an awful lot of those races. And quite a few of my riders really stood out in those races and performed really well. And then they've kept that going and have just started jumping back into the racing again on Zwift. So it's a real asset. As I mentioned, it's a great platform to get involved with. And I'm really excited by the prospect of the Tour Series perhaps putting on a virtual event. And again, I've mentioned, I think British Cycling could learn a lot about this. I think they're completely being left in the dust by what Sweet Spot are doing. Why didn't British Cycling do a live streaming event last year to entice more people in and bring more eyes to the sport when we had very little on it? It's just, again, frustration from my perspective as a team manager. I'm looking to our federation with kind of some hope and optimism. But again, it's external parties kind of like Sweet Spot are absolutely blasting them out of the water at the moment. So I'm hopeful that things might change there and we might get some kickback from British Cycling with it too.
Well, we spoke in our last podcast, didn't we, Phil, about the impact of a new CEO that Brian Fraser has come in. He has a very impressive track record in rugby. He's a cyclist by instinct, by nature, it seems. He's a guy who enjoys time on the bike. You can give us a pretty clear insight into the impact that a new CEO can have on a major organization. Give us a sense of that. How do you think he could be the catalyst? Eric Rousel's doing some good work, but of course he is one figure in a major business. It's the person leading the organization that can make the biggest change. If you know, Brian is minded that way, could he set BC on a similarly influential path to Sweet Spot?
I'm sure. As I explained on that last podcast, really, Tim, any new CEO comes in normally spends about 100 days, what we call strategic sensing. They do an awful lot of listening. And then what they do is they come up with their own plan. But I think the big difference between organisations like British Cycling, of course, is things like their articles of association mean there's quite a limit on what you can and can't do. It's not like you're just an entrepreneur running a business and you want to come in and change everything. There's a massive governance structure that exists in the federation, which you know, is written in tablets of stone. And if you want to change it, it's a big process to change it. So I think what he will do is, you know, if it were me, you come straight in and you very quickly identify what you can change and what you can't change. You get the key people in that are responsible for the key areas. You listen to them and say, well, if you were me, what would you do? And then you bring that all back and you start to create your own strategic plan. So I would say we probably need to give him a little bit more breathing room to do his listening and to do, you know, to bring his own ideas to the fore. That will ultimately wind itself through some sort of board process where somebody will sign off some sort of new strategic plan and off they go from there. So I think for the 2021 season, we're not going to probably see very much, which might, you know, give us some brand new image of what things are going to be like. But I think we've got to hold our breath and hopefully come 2022, there will be a couple of operating plans. One will be, hey, everyone, it's back to how things were. We're all vaccinated. Have as many events as you like. off we go. And the second one is maybe the environment might stay similar. Well, what do we now do to sort of up our game and not have a season where we're just really the victim of events? What you've got to do is put yourself into that theatre and say, well, if this is another year like this, what do we now need to do? Well, it might be we've got to launch the e-racing league. We've got to assume that all the races may well be cancelled. So what's our plan B? What are we going to do about making that event, you know, like this, if that happens? So there's probably going to be a little bit more contingency planning needed, because, you know, if you're to learn anything from the last year or so, it's ever so important to have contingency plans when you're hit by unexpected events. And maybe the COVID pandemic was probably very close to what we call a black swan event. But now we would definitely see that as part of our everyday risk that we would manage as a business.
Just while before we finish singing the praises of Sweet Spot, Simon, I wanted to get your insight into a development that will affect your UCI team particularly, and that's that the women's tour is going to be on this new GCN race pass, and that was widely sort of celebrated by Sweet Spot and GCN as a bit of a game changer. And we've talked a lot, Phil and I, in various episodes about the impact of television, whether it still means as much in the new digital landscape, in the failure, you know, readily admitted by British Cycling, of the Eurosport coverage of the National Road Series. And we talked then, Phil and I, about, well, would the GCN race pass change the game if you put the National Road Series on it and just had it accessible on demand rather than waiting till 11:30 on a Wednesday night 2 weeks after the race had been held? So let's just get your thoughts on the women's tour being on the race pass as the manager of a women's team that will take part in that event. How important is that to you?
Well, for me, actually, it is massive. I know there's different views and different opinions on whether TV coverage still has the same value, but to still market yourself on TV or to advertise on TV still does come with a huge price tag. So in comparison to sponsoring a cycling team, you're actually getting, as I think Phil's words were before many times, good pound for your buck type thing, good coverage for your buck. So, and GCN and Eurosport, they are avenues and channels that many cyclists and non-cyclists do follow or subscribe to. So it's a great way to create a bigger audience to those that maybe haven't seen cycling before. And GCN particularly, you know, without, I don't know, advertising them, for want of a better description, there is a huge following on GCN of non-racing cyclists. They're probably their biggest audience is those sportif riders, those riders who ride with their friends, and they're the audience we want to get to, particularly CAMS, you know, one of our sponsors, that's their audience. So for me and for our partners, it's huge. I think it has added great value, and certainly isn't a negative, that's for sure.
And if we could get, I say we, as a sport, get the National Road Series on the GCN app, would that make a difference? How about you, Matt? What's your thoughts on that?
Yes, in a word, I think that would be a massive positive. It would also, from a TV perspective, it would create a real attraction to your sponsorship proposal if you were looking for prospective sponsors for the following year. Having TV times, like Simon has already mentioned, it's significant amounts of money to put a brand in front of a camera and get it onto TV, and that's an opportunity for sponsors if they have a team that's actually racing on a televised platform. So yeah, I think it would be a massive opportunity and bring a lot of eyes to the national series here in the UK. You know, we have some of the best riders in the country competing in these rounds, and you know, you only look at like the likes of Matt Holmes making a step up to World Tour and winning World Tour races. He's come from that breeding ground. He's the direct result of that type of racing, and I think it would really motivate the riders as well, knowing that they have a shot being on TV. What an opportunity that would be for riders, and I'm sure that would help animate the races a bit better more. Actually, knowing that they are televised and knowing that there's a growing audience following it, I think that it would animate the races a lot, and it bring a bit more excitement to the series too.
Ian, we were talking the other week, just over a text message, if I recall, or an email, about you just got yourself another sponsor, which was just great. One of the local businesses to where you previously were in the Northwest, which I thought was brilliant, and sort of links this point really. You know, if you're talking to a customer, potential sponsor like that, and you've either got this GCN coverage or you don't have this GCN coverage, surely it must make a difference to you when you're having that conversation, because without it, you're having a very different conversation. It's a real amplifier, isn't it? Or a bigger hook for you to land a new name into your, you know, financial sponsorship mix.
100% it is, yeah, because as sponsors, it is to get the exposure and you want to see their name out there and to get the advertising benefits of doing that. But of course, as well, it's to get that kick out of seeing that company out there as well, you know, so it's a massive thing. Yeah, I mean, if you can give some sponsors that reassurance that they're going to be seen and they're going to be on TV, and it's massive. It's half the battle, because at the moment we're just saying that we'll give you social media presence, which is good. It's still good, but you know, you're getting social media presence and some media news and that sort of thing. So yeah, it is really big, and it helps a lot.
I think it's quite a smart move myself. You know, I've subscribed. You know, they're doing a subscription option right now. And £19.99, I think it was. So I thought, well, why not? I already have Eurosport at home. But we're living in a world now of on-demand, but we're also living in a world of on-device. So it's on-demand and on-device, which gives you both. And I think this sort of new partnership probably gives far more ability to market to that audience than perhaps than you would through, you know, conventional broad TV. So now you're sort of, You're instead of becoming a billboard, you're becoming much more of a specialist magazine, if you see what I mean, going to your exact target audience, where actually the things that you do have much more resonance because you're speaking to the audience who've already got a desire to be involved in the scene or your product or your team. So I think that there's probably in the midterm, it's probably going to be quite a smart move, that one by Sweet Spot, to get that collaboration going. And I think Simon's point was a really, really, really good one. How do you get more people who are just involved, perhaps for their own leisure purposes, interested in UK domestic racing? And if that platform now can be such that we can get domestic racing shown more and you can widen the audience that effectively want to be interested in that, that can only be good for the mid to long term, for the sport, for the teams, for the organisers, because ultimately, end of the day, there might be more money around.
Well, we're knocking on the door here of an hour's recording. It feels like we're just getting started. There are plenty more topics to cover, so let's call a temporary halt here and publish the rest of this conversation in a second episode. Phil, Matt, Simon, Ian, thank you very much indeed for joining me. Thanks to everybody else out there for listening. You can check back soon on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify for the second half of this conversation and to enjoy all of our published episodes. So we'll call a halt here temporarily. We'll be back with the second half of this episode as soon as we can. So please keep your eyes peeled for that on the platforms that I've just mentioned. And in the meantime, of course, in these very strange times, please stay safe.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, please hit subscribe.